Okay, so now here's a part of the teaching which may seem very strange if you haven't come across this before. So just, it took me years and years and years to hear this, and it didn't really make a whole lot of sense to me. But I feel like now it's sort of unlocked a key for me, one more key, and sort of chipping away at this illusion of a separate self. So it's really worth paying attention to. So the Buddha said that we should practice like this. We should know the six sense bases or organs, the six sense objects, and the six sense consciousnesses. Okay. So one thing we have to know about this, first of all, is that the Buddha taught that there are six senses, the five we identify normally with, plus the mind. The mind is a sense organ, which is really interesting because, you know, if you lost your sense of taste, do you think you'd still be you? But if you lost your mind, would you still be you? You know, we assign much more value to our mind, but the Buddha says it's an organ because it's how we take in the world. It's how we experience the world. So the six sense organs or bases we know, you know, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. And then the six sense objects is the object of our attention. So it's seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and thinking. And then the six sense consciousnesses is the awareness of the organ and its object. So it's eye consciousness. So this will make a little more sense when we go on. So the insight, the trick about this is that these 18 realms, the three sixes, they create everything. They create all we ever experience. So this is a really good thing to think about. Is there anything that you ever experience that's not the contact of these senses with an object? So we can begin to see it. To me, what it does is it kind of opens up the door and makes me see that this is all we're doing. You know, it's like when we call the five aggregates is really a description of us, and they're just heaps of stuff. The word skanda literally means heap. So they're a heap of form, of material stuff, a heap of feelings, a heap of thoughts, a heap of perceptions, and a heap of consciousness. And in the same way, this is what we are, with these flowing sense impressions. And then the fetter, which we'll discuss next week, is what keeps us limited in our thinking. It's the thing that blocks us, that limits us in our experience of eye consciousness, etc. So the Buddha taught this in a very concise way one time when this man met the Buddha on the road. And he said, "Oh, dear Buddha," he said, "I really want to know what you teach." And he said, "I'm also really in a hurry. I don't have much time. I have to be somewhere." And the Buddha said, "Well, why don't we sit down and have some tea?" And he said, "No, I would love to, but I'm sorry. I'm just way too busy. But I really, really want to know what you teach." And so, you know, he asked three times. Finally, the Buddha stopped and thought about it for a minute. And he said, Okay, I'm going to tell you everything." And this is called the Sutra on the All, the Sabha Sutra. And this is what the Buddha said. "Bhikkhus, I will teach you the all. Listen, attend to it carefully, and I will speak. Now, bhikkhus, what is the all? It is just the eye and visible objects, the ear and sound, the nose and odors, the tongue and taste, the body and touch, intangible objects, the mind in the objects of mind. This, bhikkhus, is called the all. Now, whoever should speak thus, setting aside this all, saying, I will proclaim another all, it would be mere talk on his part. And on being questioned, he would be unable to proceed. And in addition, vexation would befall him. For what reason? It would not be within his scope of the all. So this is the description, the definition of the all, these consciousnesses, these sense spheres. So it's really interesting because we think our lives are so vast and complex, but everything comes from this flow of energy and attention. It's like a six-piece chamber orchestra playing the music of our lives, of everything. Yeah. So chew on that for a while. And I want to talk a little bit about consciousness, because consciousness can seem very confusing to me, at least. What do we mean by consciousness? And we know from our previous teaching that there's mind consciousness and store consciousness, which is kind of like a collective consciousness. But the teacher Usilananda said this, consciousness is that which is aware of an object. It is the bare awareness of an object. And mental factors are what color consciousness. They arise together with the consciousness and they color the consciousness. So the mental factors are, you know, we know what they are, greed, hatred, delusion, faith, wisdom, you know, all those mental formations, that list. So when you say, for example, have anger in your mind, and you know it, and you practice anger, identifying anger, you are practicing the contemplation of your consciousness. So what's interesting is, according to one teacher, science has no consensus on the definition of consciousness. The Buddha did, though. The Buddha said that consciousness is that which is luminous and cognizant. So it does two things. It illuminates something. It shines a light on something, the light of awareness. And then the second part is it recognizes or cognizes. So it can recognize your hand, for example. So if you look at your hand, it may seem to happen simultaneously, but there's the light of awareness and then there's the recognition, this is my hand. You know, and you can think that there might be times where you might have a sense impulse, you might hear a noise, but you can't identify it. There's no cognition to it, there's just, you know. So you can perceive something without understanding it. So they're two separate things that consciousness does. So you need several conditions in order for consciousness to arise. Like for with eye consciousness, you need light, for example. You know. But you need an eye, you need a visible object, and you need attention. So that's how eye consciousness arises. And here's a really important point that the Buddha made. This helps us understand non-self and interbeing. Consciousness is a conditioned phenomenon. It's not a permanent phenomenon. Here we are with our pearl view of self thinking, I am this consciousness and I go around and I experience whatever comes along, right? But the Buddha says very clearly that consciousness is not sitting there waiting for an object to appear. It arises and passes like everything else. So if there's no attention, if there's no object, if there's no light, if there's no eye, if there's any one of those missing, there's no eye consciousness. It's not possible. So we can, and we get very fooled, I think, by the rapidity of how fast this happens. Like the example of if you've seen someone with a torch of fire and they spin it around in a circle like this really fast, it looks like there's a ring of fire, but really there's only one point of fire. There's one torch going around. And it's going so fast that it looks like it's a whole ring. So this helps me think, realize and understand, you know, consciousness arises like that. rather than having it be this center of me that goes out to the world. So there's two ways to help us cultivate an investigation of consciousness. And we were doing that in the exercise. First way is by both paying closer attention to it and then moving back from it. So if there's a mind, there's an object of our mind, we pay very close attention to it. A thought or a feeling or an object. And then we can also reframe it in a passive voice. So it's like instead of my knee is feeling really tight, it's like tightness is happening. A sound is being known rather than I hear. So it's a way of sort of disidentifying with this center of the universe way of experiencing the world. So the Buddha's instructions on how to contemplate all this is, quote, one knows the eye, the visible forms, and the fetter that arises dependent on both, and then, of course, for each consciousness. So the challenge is to see and understand all these sense objects and bases as conditioned rather than belonging to this I that we often believe in. Because consciousness can be the last hideout of the self. No. It's really difficult to see that there's not an I there at the center. You could do an exploration with these senses, like you could explore taste. Maybe your dinner that you eat, you could take a few minutes and you're aware of the tongue, which is the sense base, the organ, and you're aware of the object, the food that you're putting in your mouth, and you're aware of your awareness of it, but you don't have to identify that it's you. There's taste consciousness happening. So it's really fun to play with, to just kind of challenge this idea that I'm here at the center tasting this, and then I'm doing that, and then I'm hearing this, and then that, So there always has to be an organ, an object of attention, and a consciousness for something to manifest. It can't happen, if you don't have a tongue, taste consciousness won't happen. If you don't have a piece of food, it won't happen. And if you don't have the awareness, then that taste consciousness won't be present. So one of our many wonderful Zen ancestors said that this careful examination allows us to disidentify with the array of passing phenomenon, which are constantly streaming, And he called it empty phenomena rolling on. No one's behind it. I think of it as the sort of the Wizard of Oz syndrome, that we think we're the Wizard of Oz great and powerful or whatever he said, It's like, nah, not there. So there was a Japanese nun in our history too that really understood this, and she saw phenomena arising and fading away, and she also saw the knowing of it arising and fading away, the consciousness of it arising and fading away. She saw that this was it, that there was nothing more than this. There was no ground. There was nothing to lean on. There was no one doing the leaning. And so the way she described it was, They opened, the clenched fist of her mind opened, let go, and fell into the midst of everything. So that's just a little story of where we can go with this. So what I'd like to do now is to read you a paragraph from a different book of Tithes that I found, and I'd like us to do it in a meditation. But I'm just going to, you know, if we just sit in a meditation position and follow our breathing, and then I'd just like to read this to you. And just take in whatever words work for you and let go of whatever doesn't. It's just all these different ways of saying the same thing. Because we all have different flavors that work for us better than others. Sitting in meditation, direct your concentration onto the interdependent nature of certain objects. Whatever comes to you, it could be a falling autumn leaf. Remember that the subject of knowledge cannot exist independently from the object of knowledge. To see is to see something. To hear is to hear something. To be angry is to be angry about something. Hope is hope for something. Thinking is thinking about something. When the object of knowledge is not present, there can be no subject. Meditate and see the interbeing of the subject and the object. When you practice mindfulness of breathing, then the breathing is mind. When you practice mindfulness of the body, then your body is mind. When you practice mindfulness of objects outside yourself, these objects are mind. Therefore, the contemplation of the interbeing of subject and object is also the contemplation of the mind. Every object of the mind is mind itself. In Buddhism, we call the objects of mind the dharmas.